Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, Feast of Fates is book one of the four Feast Till Darkness series. The author, Christian A. Brown, joins me on the phone. Welcome, Christian.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. So I guess maybe the first question I want to ask is, you know, it's billed as book one in a series of four. Like, when you conceived of this, did you see it as four books, or was this the kind of thing when you sat down to write the initial book, you realized, you know, there was a much larger story or scope that you needed to kind of spread it out over multiple
parts? Yeah, well,
parts.
Definitely. I mean, I think, let's see, well, I'll try and give you the short version, but I sort of had this one idea kicking around for, you know, ever since I was a teenager. And I scribbled, I'd say, about 185 pages of something resembling a story over about 10 years. My mother got sick. I had lots of free time. I actually finished this story, and I think it came out somewhere around 500 pages. And at that point, I immediately sought out a structural editor just so I could sort of go over my work and really take a good, you know, analytical look at it. And we realized that together through the process, so editing is one of my favorite processes, actually, but we realized that I was writing the wrong story, or at least from the wrong period of time. So I had to go back and write the other four books that preceded the story that I had written. So that's where Feast of Fates came in, the four Feast Till Darkness. Those are actually the, you know, sort of founding books of the world that set the lore and the tone. So that's where we started, my editor and I, and that's where we are now.
You mentioned editing is kind of one of your favorite things. Like, what is it about the editing process that you find enjoyable? Because I know that a lot of authors kind of feel like it's, you know, taking a knife to their child or something.
Oh, I think you have to sort of get over that whole fear of criticism, because if the person, especially your editor, it's usually ideally their personal relationship, and you know, they're like your best friend, and they're also, and your best friend ideally will tell you the things that you shouldn't be doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think an editor is very much like that, and so I've been blessed with sort of just stumbling into a working relationship with Barbara Burson, and she's a former senior editor at Penguin. She's incredible. Like, she, you know, the first few times I saw her with the first few manuscripts, she just completely eviscerated my work. And I learned to get over that hurt very quickly, because, you know, she had some valid points, you know, a lot of valid points, actually. But it's very rewarding, I think, after a while to go through the process of drafting and, you know, to give another draft to an editor and have it come back with less red marks and, you know, quotations in the inside of the manuscript. So it's quite rewarding for me, I think, because I actually use it sort of as a gauge as a measure of improvement rather than as something to get upset over.
So you mentioned, you know, you go through it and you realize that, you know, there's a deeper story to it. In terms of deciding, okay, so it's essentially four stories now instead of one, and this is like one part of it, like filling out the rest of those parts, like what, like do you kind of like map it out in sort of shorthand, or like what do you do to kind of figure out what the ultimate story is? You know, if the four are under one umbrella, what's that umbrella kind of thing?
Well, I think you have that ultimate message to the book. So once I figured that out, and then each book has an arc. So I'm a firm believer that even though you can write this one very long story, which obviously has to be broken up just to make it digestible and market ready and for the readers, I still think that, you know, each book should have a beginning and an end. So I always start with, personally, just my process, I always start with that. Like, I always have a beginning and an end. And maybe, like, any particular, I'm big on, like, these sort of set PC, grander than life, you know, explosive moments. So you have to sort of plan for those a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess for, I'd say about 50% of the book and what I write, I'm kind of a pantser. I just let things happen. And that's actually another one of my favorite parts of writing is experiencing that moment where a character or an event just takes a twist that you didn't foresee or you don't feel like you planned it. Like, I'm sure on some subconscious level you have, you know, created that thread, but you don't see it on a conscious level. So, I like that sort of spontaneity in my writing and in my work.
So are you just kind of sitting down and writing and then kind of looking at what comes out of that writing session and saying, oh, I didn't expect to go there, or like?
Well, no, it's a pretty disciplined process. So I don't do like anything specific, like, you know, massive chapter outlines. Like, I'll jot down key points that need to be addressed just for the continuity and structure of the plot, like world building stuff that has to be put in to make sense, to make the world make sense. So I'll have those sort of little point formulas to go through a chapter, and then anything else that crops up that I feel is pertinent and needs to be addressed. I sit down at my computer and I'll write 4, 6 to 8 hours a day, and I give myself a page count minimum and I give myself a word minimum, and that's just what I do. So in a lot of ways, it is very much a job. It's one that I enjoy most of the time, but I found, for me at least, like, the only way to sort of move a story forward, especially if you want to, you know, treat this as a career, is you have to treat it like a career. So you have to actually sit down and do your shift, so to speak. It's not always creative and wonderful. In fact, sometimes it's quite tedious. But, you know, tedium, you can redraft. I think the most important thing is just getting it out onto the page, or onto the digital page, so to speak.
Right. You mentioned world building, and obviously in the fantasy genre, I mean, there's, you know, really like no limit, right, in terms of like what you can come up with, right? Like, this isn't, you know, trying to present a real world family or something, you know, that people are going to have to buy into the details of. You can let your imagination go and create your own world. And I'm curious what goes into, you know, making a believable world for you as the creator of that world, right? Like, what kind of thought do you give to geography, to politics, to like the variety of things that kind of go into that world building?
Well, I think you kind of touched upon it there. I mean, like, yes, you're building these, you know, extravagant and sometimes inconceivable worlds, but they still have to have an element of believability and something that sort of mirrors what we understand in order to get the reader's suspension of disbelief. So that's also very important to me. So like I don't even try, but when I write a story, even though it happens to be in this fantastical environment, you know, with, you know, various degrees of extreme science and magic and whatnot, it still has a lot of, you know, political and familial and societal, situations that mirror a lot of things that go on in Earth. So that's what I have found makes for credible fantasy, is that it's not that much different from real life. It just happens to have, you know, some extraordinary things happening that don't necessarily happen here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you picture like a place in your head, or like when you're kind of building this world, do you kind of hem it in some way? Like, you're like, okay, this would have to happen in this world, or this,
yeah.
This,
I mean, I'm a very sensory author. Like, so I get right into a scene, and so sort of like as I'm writing, I'm, you know, what you see in the book is me almost describing it to myself. So I sort of like to go into detail with all five senses if I can.
Right. Cause in, Kaneth's, like, in his house or his place of work where he's building, you talk about the sight, like, you know, that it's like dim light, and you talk about, you know, the smell of his body and the material
too.
That he's working on and stuff like that. Obviously you're kind of getting a sense of this in your head before you write it on the page.
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, there's different authors have different ways to write, for sure. And some people like to read the leader, lead the reader less. And some people like to lead them a little bit more. I'd say I sort of tread that. Like, I mean, I leave enough that they can fill in the details or the blanks, but I still like to give certain details just to really make a scene pop.
Right. Now, you mentioned, obviously, you know, even in fantasy, you have to have some sort of like thing that ties the reader to belief, right? Like that they, something that keeps them grounded in some way.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, did you approach this as like sort of like allegorical thing about, you know, our world portrayed in this kind of fictional world? Or did the allegory kind of grow out of just the story itself?
I think the allegory grew out of the story. Like, I mean, and again, going back to that thing about how I'm kind of a pantser, like, characters do tend to surprise me a lot with what I write. Like, my story is sort of, it's a pretty organic process for me. It's very exciting. Like, when it's good, it's really good. And I'm living in that world, and I'm sort of a traveler along with the events that are unfolding. And so that's when it's most exciting. But yeah, I mean, I didn't set out to make any grand political statement. I think just because of my own history and, you know, my experience with my mom and some of my devices background, I think that stuff just found its way into my work.
So when you say your relationship with your mom, like, is the Morrigan relationship with her mother somewhat grounded in your own relationship with your mother, or?
Well, I think there's a lot of elements of maternal love in the book. And there's a lot of elements just about family, like questions of family and questions of, you know, honor towards family and ties of love. But yeah, I mean, I was my mother's basically caregiver while she was in cancer care for 2 years. And I gave up, I don't want to say gave up, actually, that's a horrible thing to say. I changed my life for 2 years so that I could be with her. And it changed me as a human being, and it humbled me and taught me a lot of things about being a good person and empathy and humanity. And so, you know, what you read in Feast of Fates would not have been written before that whole experience.
And it sounds like maybe some of her relationship with Thackeray, the sorcerer, might be based on then,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like, I mean, like being a caregiver. And
yeah, and they both have experienced loss, because Morgan has lost her mother and Thackeray has lost his family through this rather gruesome series of events. And just, you know, for those readers out there that have not read Feast of Fates yet, I do tackle some pretty grisly events, because that's just the world, unfortunately. Like, bad things happen in the world. But I don't think it's necessarily about, you know, the event itself. It's more about how people deal with it that interests me. You know, that's how heroism is formed, is people, bad things happen to people all the time. So I'd like to explore sort of what they do after that bad event. But yes, Morgan and Thackeray are very much, they have this this father-daughter relationship. I like it. I think it's quite cute.
Right. Now, I wanted to, I mean, I don't want to give away any plot points, because obviously, like, a story, you know, can rely on those in terms of, you know, like, not knowing where something's going and then discovering it, right? But talking about Morgan and Thackeray, I was curious, because obviously in sort of the culture right now, the talk about, you know, female agency in fantasy. And, mm-hmm. you know, Thackeray, you know, sometimes wants to help, but maybe isn't a bit ineffectual, right? Like in terms of what he's capable of. And it really does kind of come down to Morrigan and her own inner capabilities. And
totally,
And I was curious about, you know, was this written in response to, or like with the idea that, you know, female agency isn't necessarily always represented well in the genre?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I mean, I've gladly accepted the label that I've been given as sort of this feminist fantasy writer. But I've never set out to write, like, I didn't have, like, okay, I have a certain quota of men and a certain quota of women in the story. It just sort of turned out that, you know, some of the major villain, like the Black Queen and even Gloria Atrix, and who's wonderfully scheming and evil, they just happen to be women. And same with the you know, there's a very strong male lead in the story as well, too. Like, Cain is obviously a very manly entity. Yeah, I didn't set out necessarily to write something that had strong female leads, but you just write characters and you try and think of what they would do, like what strong characters would do. And it doesn't matter whether you're male or female to be a strong character. You don't have to be male or female. And you can still possess, you know, these archetypal characteristics of your sex. Like, Morgan still likes to wear pretty dresses sometimes. She doesn't need them. You know, I think she wears like one or two throughout the whole story, and most of the time she's just sort of in whatever's around. But, you know, she still has those aspects of traditional femininity while still being kind of kick-ass. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, she really is not scared of very many situations.
Right, that one doesn't stand in opposition to the other.
Exactly, yeah. So you can be, like, women can be many things, and they can be multifaceted. And I think I'm lucky in that I grew up with a lot of really strong female role models that showed me that, yes, you can be a mother, you can be sexy, you can be a working mother, you can be all those things at once, you can be whatever. Like, a woman wear so many roles and so many hats to begin with, that it's a little strange to me that there's not a bit more representation.
Do you have a sense, like, you know, as a creator, why that might be the case? Like, is this just a bastion of you know, backwards thinking in times?
It is, and it's also like traditionally, you know, you have the fantasy genre has been stymied sort of by this. Women just have been portrayed very poorly in fantasy in general, you know, and even the stuff that I read when I was growing up, it was very, you know, machismo and bravado filled, and it was very bromancy even back then. And women were just sort of window dressing. So I think it takes a while to have that sort of cultural shift. And we're seeing that in a lot of different areas, obviously, like politically and socially. But these things take, you know, tens to hundreds of years to sort of initiate a change like that. So I don't think you're going to see a huge sweeping change in how fantasy is written for some time. And you're always going to have these traditional stories, and that's fine. I think people are entitled to have traditional beliefs. Like, I'm not about, like, oh, you know, everyone must be empowered and every woman must, you know, be her best woman. If her best woman is, you know, taking care of two kids and going to church bingo every Sunday, that's fine. That's her choice. And I think we need to respect that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's a very interesting landscape, particularly with fantasy, where those ideas are just so entrenched of, you know, especially with women, you have, like, you know, princess, maiden in distress, chainmail, bikini clad warrior princess, which is just not very sensible. I mean, you know, it's not very sensible to go into an armed melee with, you know, a chainmail bikini on. And so you just have these stereotypes, which are just there, and it'll take a while for them to go away.
Right. I mean, a lot of times it's presented as like their purpose is in relation to the, like, central male character, right? Like, that, you know.
Yes.
It's a reactive thing, not a...
Someone to be saved, someone to make the man angry.
Right. So with Morgan, you mentioned, you know, you didn't necessarily set out to make all these female characters, you know, powerful within the context of the story, but, like, did you... What did you envision when you were, say, creating Morgan, right? Like, did you have an idea consciously, or did she just kind of take shape as you wrote her?
She took a little bit of shape, and, I mean, even she gets put in the traditional damsel in distress situation at one point. But as soon as that happens, like, I'm like, okay, well, what would a courageous, you know, empowered woman do in this situation? And she immediately looks for a way out. So, you know, you can still put your characters, and you can still have characters that are in these, you know, traditional fantasy situations. But it's all about, I think, dealing with them in more modern ways. Because as soon as she's trapped at one point, she immediately looks for escape, and she doesn't stop. And she becomes very clever with some of the stuff she does, like, well, you've read further in the book than I probably should share. But, you know, like, she comes up with some pretty clever stuff to get herself out of that situation. And she uses even resources, just the resources of her mind, even when she's completely physically restrained at one point. So, yeah, she surprised me with a lot of the stuff she did. And I would say I quite enjoy her writing her character just because she surprises me quite often.
Right. I want to pivot away from the discussion of female agency to, I want to kind of maybe address something that I had a question about, and that is sort of like the dichotomy or the, like, perceived thing about, you know, the natural world versus sort of the industrial world, or, like, you know, magic versus you know, non, like, a material kind of approach to things, right? Like, Kenneth seems to represent sort of a bridge with that in some way. I mean, because he's, you know, half wild and half not wild.
Cultured. No, very much so, yeah.
Right. And was that something that came out of writing, or, like, was there some thought to looking at this bridge or this divide?
Well, again, I think it's one of those things that we struggle with as a society, too. Like, even my sister purchased this property out in the country after my mom passed away. And so she lives this semi-rural life, and we were just having this really interesting conversation one day, just sitting on her, you know, country porch, and I think we were even, like, drinking lemonade or something, completely, you know, stereotypical for the image. And we were just talking about, like, just the prevalence of nature there, and how her children, who, you know, had grown up mostly in a metropolitan environment, they were running around outside, and they were, you know, touching trees and experiencing it and picking up leaves and looking at, you know, those, I forget what you call them, those little things that look like propellers that fall off of those apple trees. And they're just playing with all this stuff in nature that they've never seen before. And so, you know, that was one of those sort of experiences that got me. And I was writing the manuscript at that point, or writing a draft of it. I think it had seven. And that was one of the experiences that stuck with me, just about how, you know, we're losing touch with the natural world. And, you know, even what, you know, what her children see today will be completely different from what their children see in 30 years. And yeah, that the poignancy of that loss sort of stuck with me. And also my partner is Native Canadian, and so very strong connection to nature and the elements. And so I've had those influences around me, but they sort of, snuck their way into my work, I guess you could say. And it's just another one of those conflicts that I think is interesting about, you know, technology versus nature. And even there's in the book, there's technomagic, which is sort of a fusion of both.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a lot of those elements in the book.
Right. And I mean, the city itself, there's like, you know, in some ways sort of built atop nature, right? Like that there's that, the secret cave that, you know, exists underground, that it seems to suggest that, you know, either not necessarily turning your back on it, but just like hiding the natural within the context of the.
Yeah. Realm. There's sort of this discussion about, you know, whether technomagic is exerting its superiority over nature, or whether it works in tandem with nature. And you see that argument sort of bend, like, you know, back and forth throughout the story. And, you know, you have Eod, which is the Western society, which sort of mirrors, you know, the ideals and freedoms that we aspire to here in the West. And then you have Minos in the East, city of Ireland. They're just horrific, you know, technomagical gargantuas that just do whatever they want. And, you know, they're sort of like, it's like, what would we have if we had extreme science without ethics? So you have these two very, you know, diametrically opposed arguments on each side of the world. And there's all sorts of fun you can have with that too, as a writer.
Right. Like, did you find maybe your ambition or the fun that you wanted to have had to be kind of curtailed in order to kind of work for the story? Like, was that something that in the editorial process, you know, oh, this has got like kind of too much of a flight of fancy, or, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think that fundamentally I'm still a character driven writer. That's what I tend to write first. I'm more interested in the human drama and everything else. Not that it's window dressing, like it all affects the human drama, but I'd like to see, you know, I like to see it on a personal level, how these massive events affect people on a personal level. So that was sort of the one thing is finding that balance with my editors about, you know, how much of the world do you, I'm not one of those writers that dwells in the overly political stuff. Mm-hmm. Just because as a reader, I get lost or disinterested. It bores me, to be honest with you. And I just, my mind just starts to drift. So, you know, you're supposed to write what you know, and what I know and what I like is character drama.
So I'm guessing the taxation stuff of the Star Wars Episode One was not your favorite.
No.
I'm guessing though that plot is in service to the person rather than the other way around for you in terms of storytelling then.
Yes, I would say that. Yeah. But plot still has to. I like to think that I'm very meticulous with my plot threads. So I need to make sure that everything is tidy. And I always, that's one of the things that my editors and I always check for, because there's a lot of different threads in the story that they all sort of weave together at some point.
Right. And then, you know, having this as one part of the full tapestry, then, like, how much editing had to be about weaving it into, you know, three other stories, right? Like, how much tooling?
Well, I mean, it's just a lot of work.
Yeah.
it's a tremendous, and now I've got it down to sort of a system now, which is good. Because I think, like, so the second book the first book is coming out in retail stores in about a week or two. The second book has just finished its print galley, and I'm reading that as we speak. The third book is in its second draft. So I've actually learned, which is fantastic. It took a while rather than just running around like a chicken with my head cut off. But now I can actually juggle all these different things and allocate so much time to one thing, so much time to another thing, and so on without getting overwhelmed. But it's just a lot of work, essentially, to get everything organized and out the door.
Right. And I'm guessing then you're more than halfway there then if you're on the third book in terms of writing.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So everything, and I think there's enough momentum by, the second book is quite pivotal, but there's enough momentum by that point. I also wanted to make sure, because there's that second book curse that authors have where the second one they release is always a bit of a, you know, wet noodle. So I really wanted to make sure it actually started. It's a pretty strong book. It's definitely stronger and has a bit more adrenaline to it than the first one. And the plot is just constantly moving because all of the groundwork has been laid, which is great. And yeah, the third one picks up from there, and the fourth one escalates into a pretty explosive climax, and there we are. But yeah, it's all taking shape now, because I'll probably start the fourth manuscript by the end of June. But it's all I can see the end now, which is nice.
So if you're at the galley stage for the second one, do you have like kind of a estimated release date for that? Like
that'll be out by next month.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then retail stores shortly afterwards. So and we'll be doing like a press release and pre-release party and stuff, all sorts of stuff.
Right on. Well, so you said Feast of Fates, the first book, is about to launch in stores.
Well, that's just getting a wider retail distribution. So that'll be in Chapters Indigo. You can go pick that up at your local retail store. It's already in certain boutiques, but it's going to hit like mass market distribution within a week or two. Well, it'll be out the door in a week or two, and then it has to roll into retail channels.
Via their trucks and such.
And then the second book will be out next month, and then again rolled out, and the third book will be out, I'm going to aim for, I think, December, so everyone can have a nice little Christmas treat under the tree.
Well, and after you're done book one, it doesn't sound like you'll have to wait too long to pick up the second volume, at least.
Yeah.
Christian, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about the book.
Well,
really
thank you
appreciate
for having
it.
Me. No, it was great.